Well, it's great to be back. Just got off the plane a few days ago from Australia. Spent 2 weeks there. But I do want to thank Rich Dean for those wonderful lessons you got on genetics. And I've been told that unlike Fuzz, he doesn't speak in tongues. Manages to keep it down to just 6 syllables per word. So appreciate, Rich, that you're able to keep things so accessible for the class. And wish I'd been here. By the way, one thing I discovered when I was in Australia is how many people actually participate in this class. They get the MP3s. So we have a lot of Australians that are part of the Paradoxes class. By the way, my sons woke me up this morning and I said, you know, Dad, it's a holiday. And I said, what kind of holiday are you talking about? And this is Star Wars Day. May the 4th be with you. I mean, gee, but apparently everybody's celebrating it. I mean, putting on T-shirts and everything. So I reminded my sons that, you know, I'm not a Star Wars fan because once they started talking about a galaxy far, far away, hey, we look far, far away. We don't see any spiral galaxies that could possibly be candidates for advanced life. Of the tens of thousands we've looked at, this is the only one. And that's one reason why there is a growing consensus that Earth is the only possible place in the universe where advanced life is possible. So hopefully I've spoiled your enjoyment for Star Wars Day. Well, no, I didn't really mean to do that. But before I give a quick report in Australia and then get into our lesson, these are just a few slides I took while I was there. We could kind of take the lights down. That will help. That creature is a wallaby, or what you would call a miniature kangaroo. And Tasmania is the best place for wildlife. I started off in Tasmania, and there were 3 wallabies that actually come right up to the door of the apartment where I was staying. So here's another little shot.
They have pouches,
they have tails, they jump and leap. I mean, they're just like kangaroos, only they're smaller. They come in at about a maximum of 50 pounds. But these ones were like 20 to 30 pounds. So, and here's a couple of them together. So, yeah, quite friendly. So, and did a lot of speaking in Tasmania. But we had about a 3-hour break, and my sponsor took me to see their national park. And this is Crescent Mountain. And going to Australia, I knew it was going to be in the 90s and high humidity. So I kind of didn't take warm clothes. This place, the temperature was a couple degrees above freezing, and it was a 20-mile-an-hour wind. So I walked fast. And this is the family that was walking with me. And that 7-year-old girl likes to walk really fast, too. So we would do all right. So that was interesting, is there was this group of men in their early 20s, and they were doing the trail, but they were exhausted. And the 7-year-old girl said, oh, no big deal, I did it. So he says, guys, we're going to do it. They were not going to be embarrassed by a 7-year-old girl. But this is, it's a rainforest area, as you can see, and a waterfall. It was raining the whole time and foggy. Pardon me?
Rainforest in Australia?
Tasmania.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. Because Tasmania, you're facing the roaring 40s of the South Indian Ocean. And yeah, that dumps a lot of rain. So it's, you know, up there by Darwin, you get rain too. But there's actually some rainforest.
Did you see a Tasmanian devil?
I did not see any Tasmanian devils. They do exist there. But I actually got to see 2 wombats, and a lot of Tasmanians have told me they've never seen one in their whole life. And the wombats are nocturnal, but the reason why we saw them is because it was so rainy and cloudy and dark that the wombats thought it was still night. So they came out and I got to see them. They're really cute animals. They're kind of like a porcupine without the quills and a big fat face. So this is... My host suffering through lunch. So we ate our lunch very fast given how cold it was. So they're trying to smile, but you see they're having a hard time. but not this character. He showed up to help us with our lunch. This is a native Tasmanian bird. It's a close-up of him. So, and again, quite friendly. There's another idea of what it looks like. But mainly I was inside auditoriums like this. And this is kind of the main event when I was in Tasmania. I was in the town of Launceston. It's the second largest city in Tasmania, which isn't saying much. Hobart's got 200,000 people. And Launceston's got 75,000 if you include the greater metropolitan area, which is about a 30-mile diameter around the city. But this is about 45 minutes before the event. And they told me it was the largest Christian event that they've had in Tasmania in 35 years.
Wow.
Over 900 people showed up for the evening lecture that I gave there. So, and that went really well. And a couple of facts about Australia. It's a place where we do have two functioning chapters, one in Sydney and one in Perth, Reasons to Believe chapters. But I think we're going to be seeing at least two more chapters being launched, one in Brisbane and one in Tasmania. Australia is 23.5 million people and 3 million square miles. So it ranks as one of the least densely populated countries in the world. And but what's interesting about Australia, and it might actually explains its religious demographics, almost everybody lives in big cities. So, for example, Sydney, 4.7 million, Melbourne, 4.2, Brisbane, 2.2, Perth, 1.9, Adelaide, 1.3. That's 62% of the entire population. Only 2 million people live in small towns or on farms. So it's a highly urbanized society. And if you've heard me say here before that there's a direct correlation between urbanization and atheism, that, you know, if you read my book on Job, if you're out there in the rural areas, you do see animals like these wallabies and kangaroos and wombats and koala bears. And there's a message that God speaks through the animals, particularly the wild animals. But if you're living in cities, you don't get exposed to that. And that's something we've seen over the past 100 years, that there's a direct correlation between the rise in the percentage of people who live in cities and those who declare themselves as agnostics and atheists. Now, here's the official religious demographics of Australia. 35% Protestant, 25% Roman Catholic, but only 5% attend church more than twice a year. So it's kind of like Canada in that sense. 33% identify themselves as atheists or agnostics. And as far as I know, I think that ranks as one of the highest percentages in the world. But again, I would attribute that to the high urbanization. And as I talk to pastors and church leaders, you know, the statistic here is that somewhere between 65 and 80% of the children and youth raised in the church wind up leaving the church and not coming back. The percentage in Australia is 98%. So 98% of kids raised in the church leave the church and never return. Now, one reason I went... Yeah, go ahead.
I was just curious, what's the percentage of Jews in Australia?
Quite a bit lower than here. I mean, there are Jews in Australia. I did get to meet some. But it's nowhere near the percentage that you've got in Canada and the United States. As they said, it's a little bit harder to get to Australia. So, one reason I went to Australia is that Australia is where we're getting the most trouble and problems for Reasons to Believe. It seems to be the great exporter of the most extreme forms of creationism, and also the most extreme forms of atheism. And so I've been to Australia before, though it was 20 years ago that I visited Australia. And back then I saw it as the most spiritually polarized country in the world. It's even more polarized today than it was back then. So, and the polarization is this. Within the Christian community, there's a lot of people in the mainline churches that basically go to church twice a year, and I would refer to them as deistic evolutionists. They believe in God, but God doesn't play any role in the history of nature or the lives of individual human beings.
Well, what about people like, say, who live in Alice Springs, in those areas?
Well, I didn't get to Alice Springs, and it doesn't have a large population. I mean, where I went was Launceston, which is the second largest city in Tasmania, and then Perth, and then on to Brisbane. And particularly Brisbane, because I knew that was the heart of the polarization that we see in Australia. I mean, 20 years ago, I would go to Australia and go into a university auditorium, and you can almost draw a line down the middle. Angry and hostile young earth creationists on one side, and angry and hostile atheists on the other side, glaring at one another before I got to speak. Fortunately, they hated one another more than they hated me. I've always been challenged by that. How can you bring these warring parties to reconciliation? And I actually got to see that 20 years ago, where I would see these atheists and these young earth creationists shaking hands with one another, saying, you know, we were both wrong, and actually both embracing the day-age perspective we have at Reasons to Believe. But going back this time, I saw that it was more polarized. Matter of fact, I only got to speak in one university. That was the University of Western Australia. And the reason why, as I said, young earth creationist organizations have become much more extreme than they were 20 years ago. And they basically have made it impossible for Christians to get onto a university campus. What you're hearing is university presidents and faculty chairs just basically saying, we're not having any Christian speakers on this campus. We've seen what they do, and we don't want them. And mainly because these young earth creations organizations that are headquartered there, they basically have a message that the scientific community is an enemy. It's an enemy to be destroyed, not a mission field to be won. And, of course, that doesn't score a lot of points in the university campus. Now, I was able to speak at the University of Western Australia because that university, it's a public university, but it's an anachronism. They actually have a university chaplain. I think there's only two universities in Australia that have a chaplain. And interestingly, they're both public universities. Here, it's just the private universities that have chaplains, but they have a chaplain. And I got into the chaplaincy, because the chaplaincy is allowed to have a series of public lectures. And typically, it's very liberal Christians that speak, so I was kind of, you know, the fundamentalist that was speaking there. And I'll tell you a little bit about it. The auditorium was packed, so it just shows you that people were really hungry for this kind of information. Although all the posters said, not a young earth creationist. So I think that's how they got people to come. So, and I've had to do that on some American campuses as well. But they have Christian radio in Australia. They have Christian television in Australia. And I did do quite a bit of Christian radio, not television, although some of the stuff we did in Perth may get on television. But yeah, the auditorium was packed. We had students. We had faculty, as well as a number of people from the community. But to me, the impressive thing was the impact it had on the chaplain. That I never realized there was this kind of evidence scientifically for the Christian faith. And he said, I've listened to the young earth creationists, and clearly their evidence wasn't credible, but I could tell this is really mainstream, credible scientific evidence. And so it's going to change the whole way I do my ministry. Because he introduced himself to me as a theistic evolutionist, and he basically says, boy, this is a whole different perspective, and I really like what I've heard. And he purchased a couple of our books and is going to get some more. So we'll see what happens there. And we signed up a lot of people for the Perth Reasons to Believe chapter. So, but what I saw in Tasmania, that was kind of interesting. And I got off the airplane, and literally the very next day I had to give 5 lectures.
Wow.
So, however, they did find me over there business class. I came back economy. But it says, yeah, we want you to be able to function right away. So, and I was able to do it. So I'll tell you, though, if you're any taller than me, it doesn't work. So I told Jeff Zurich, you will not be able to lie down even in business class. So But this was the big event in Tasmania, where they actually had the mayor introduce the event, and he was a Christian. And when I preached about him, he didn't behave like a politician. Because I did a major debate in Perth where they had a politician, the mayor, introduce it, and she used that as an excuse to give a long political speech. And so everybody was looking at their watches. And so I'll tell you, the amazing thing is we all expected she would walk out. She stayed for the debate and was very much engaged in the debate. But in this particular event, we had a lot of unbelievers there, and had a lot of young earth creationists there as well. And the comment I kept hearing is, "You flipped me, you turned me around." And I got that from people who were not believers saying, "Now I can believe." And also from young earth creationists. And the thing is, I never addressed the subject of the age of the earth all the time I was there. I was basically giving, you know, here are what I think are the best scientific evidences for a Christian faith, and let me show you how the Bible and science are compatible and not contradicting one another. And I met a lot of Australians who says, "All my life I believed that the Bible, particularly Genesis and science, could not possibly be reconciled." And just seeing the way you did it, it just seems so clear and so obvious, and this has made the difference for me. So, yeah, it was wonderful, and I don't think I've ever seen people get transformed that quickly. I mean, I saw all these young earth creationists basically hearing me for an hour with saying, well, one thing they told me was this. It says, when we listen to young earth creationists, they go way over their time limit. You kept to your time limit. And moreover, you stayed around to field questions and you took questions from the floor. You didn't screen them. You took them from the floor. It says, we're used to speakers coming, taking twice as much time as what we allot them. And then they got to run off. They don't have time to field questions. So just having that accessibility made a really big, big difference. And being able to answer the questions that people had, because they said, okay, what is your biggest issue? And they would lay it out. And so frequently it was, well, what do you do with Genesis and how do you fit that in with the scientific record? And so, in fact, a few places I gave my Gideon testimony of how I picked up the Gideon Bible and 8 years before I became a Christian recognized that the biblical creation texts were compatible with science. And so I never really noticed or even thought that there was any possibility of contradiction. In fact, I can tell you this. It wasn't until I came to California after getting my doctorate that I realized people had an issue with science and the Bible. I was a Christian for 8 years and just presumed everybody realizes these fit together. It's coming here to America where I realized, no, there are people who really struggle with that. So, in fact, my first encounter with younger creationists was in San Diego, where they invited me to come and speak to a bunch of Christian businessmen. And I just talk about how science and Genesis fit together. And a dozen angry men came towards me after the event was over and said, "Why didn't you mention the other position?" I said, "Well, what other position?" And they explained their young earth positions. I'd never heard of it before. And I said, "Well, you had to have seen that in the text." He said, "No, it didn't ever occur to me." So it was just so obvious these days had to be long periods of time. Well, bottom line was they got even angrier. But that was my first encounter with young earth creation. They couldn't believe I had never heard of the position before. But I was telling the truth. I had never heard of it, never even thought anybody would read the Bible from a younger perspective. Never even occurred to me anybody would see that in the text. But where does all this come from? It literally comes from Australia. The most hostile young earth creationist organizations were all started in Australia, particularly in Brisbane. I had never been to Brisbane before, so I wanted to see what it was like, and I got to see what it was like. Yeah.
Whereabouts, it seems like this is more of a recent issue, but the young earth, old earth discussion, where did it really start? Is it a fairly new issue?
It is a fairly new issue. Young earth creationists will tell you it goes all the way back to the founding fathers of the church. But what you'll see if you read the early church fathers' writings is that their whole focus was who creates and how he creates. Of their 2,000 pages of commentary on Genesis 1, less than 2 pages addresses the timescale issue. And if you read what they wrote, it's quite vague, and none of them are really taking any kind of vested position. In fact, in the debate, I did have to debate a young earth creationist when I was in Perth. In fact, they said, nobody's going to want you to come here unless you do a debate, because they didn't want to really do a debate. So I'd rather just kind of, you know, said, my goal here is to help you reach the unchurched adults that live here in Australia, which is the vast majority. And they said, well, again, anywhere in Perth, you're going to have to debate Carl Wieland. And he's the head of Creation Ministries International. And up until this date, I've refused to debate anybody from Creation Ministries International, mainly because they've written such insulting material about me and the scientific community in general. I said, look, you know, once I hear an apology from you, then I'll think about a debate. Well, they insist that they don't insult me. And that's something I've seen in the young earth creationist community. They're not aware of their tone, their attitude, and their language. And having interviewed some of these, I think I know why. You can go on our website and you'll hear some interviews we've done of leaders of young earth creationist organizations. And by the way, when we interview them, we tell them, we're not here to debate you, we're just here to ask questions. We're not going to challenge anything you say. But we always end the interview with this question. If it became clear to you that the earth really was billions of years old, how would that affect your walk with Christ? And without exception, every one of them has said, it means the Bible is not true, it means I'm not a Christian, it means I'm headed for hell.
Wow.
And what that tells us is they got no room to negotiate. Now, I look at the age of the earth as having nothing to do with salvation or biblical inerrancy. It's not in any of the creeds. But something I've seen when I was in Australia is a big push on these young earth organizations to actually put the age of the earth and the universe in the creeds of the church. Fortunately, the church is resisting that. I mean, the creeds are for the essentials of the Christian faith, not for the non-essentials. But as I spoke in Australia, it says, keep in mind this has always been part of church history. I mean, read the book of Acts. Acts chapter 15, there was a church-splitting controversy that was threatening the birth of the church. And it was a circumcision party who basically said, you can't be saved unless you're circumcised. And the main goal was to keep Gentiles out of the church. And I said, well, in one sense, I think we have a circumcision issue today. You can't really be a participant in our church unless you are believing that it's just 6,000 years for the age of the earth and the universe. And it's a great way to keep scientists and engineers out of the church. And so I've read 2,000 years of church history. The church has always come up with these church-splitting controversies that have nothing to do with salvation, that really target an unwanted people group. And this is where I think we can make for some resolution. Do we really want to set up a paradigm that's going to make it difficult for, quote, the Gentiles to come to Christ? And that's what you see in Acts 15. The Jerusalem Council said, we must not make it difficult for the Gentiles to come to Christ. But for 2,000 years, that's what's been going on. And so I was talking to people after the debate in Perth. I said, a day will come when the church is no longer divided on the age of the earth. When that happens, God will bless us with another church-splitting controversy that's got nothing to do with salvation. And so we've seen that for 2,000 years, but also I think I know why God allows that to happen. Because that was her question. You know, why does God permit these kinds of very divisive issues to come up in the church? I said, read 2 Corinthians 5:20. What does it say about followers of Christ? We are ambassadors with the mission of bringing the unsaved world to peace with God. And how is that going to work if the world can't see us successfully bringing peace to one another? And so I think God actually allows these kind of absurd controversies to infect the church in order to give us the opportunity to present a witness, an example to the world so that we can be assisted in our ministry of being, quote, peacemakers. And so I talked to a lot of pastors in Australia. I did have a chance to talk to them about the difference between the typical pastoral role which is, my job is to keep peace in the church. And says, well, your real job is to make peace in the church. And how do you make peace? You take warring parties and get them reconciled. Rather, if you ignore the problem and keep them separated, you know, okay, we'll have a class for these folks, make sure that they never meet one another. That's keeping peace. It's not making peace. Or what I've heard from a number of pastors I got to talk to in Australia, says, you know, I've never given a message on creation or Genesis because I'm worried it's going to split my church. And I says, well, that probably is also going to have an impact on how many non-Christians want to come to your church. Because, you know, they're going to come for this stuff that's going to be challenging and interesting. Got a question over here.
I was wondering, in your original assessment of Genesis, were you aware of the Semitic options from Yellow and Hebrew, or did you derive that from the English?
I drove it strictly from the English, because at age 17, looking at Genesis, it says, okay, we got 6 creation days. They're bracketed by an evening and a morning. I noticed with day 7, there was no evening and morning. And I was reading in the King James, and the King James refers to the entire creation week with the word day. So I said, okay, Genesis 2:4, it's using the word day for the whole week. Clearly, one of the definitions for the word day must include a passage of time that's greater than 24 hours. So yeah, my whole point is you don't have to know Hebrew to recognize that that word yom, translated day, has different literal definitions. It helped, too, as I went through the Bible to realize that, you know, here you got Paul talking about being taken up to the third heaven. And if you go back to Genesis 1, it uses the word heaven for 2 different entities. Creation day 2, it speaks about the place where rain clouds form. That's the first heaven. But in Genesis 1:1, it speaks about the second heaven where the stars and galaxies exist. And the third heaven that Paul was referring to is the realm beyond the universe where God and the angels would dwell and relate to one another. So, anyway, I got a text back just yesterday morning from Tasmania saying that there was an atheist that came to this event, showed up Sunday morning for a sermon message I gave, and she's no longer an atheist and is studying the Bible. Not yet a Christian, but well on her way, and very excited and motivated. So things are happening even now as a result of that. I don't know her name, so but the pastor knows her name, so that's good. Oh, and by the way, when I was in Tasmania, I met a couple that were part of this class 22 years ago.
Wow.
So, and they volunteered to launch and lead a Tasmanian chapter. So they were easy to pick out. They didn't have Australian accents. So.
Do I know them?
Probably not. I mean, this goes back a ways. And they lived in Covina, but they did come here. And someone else you might recognize, these are the officers, some of the officers of the Perth Reasons to Believe chapter. But this individual has been to our class here several times. That's Mike McCleary.
Yeah.
And he's a geophysicist and an oil exploration. That's his job. And there was a time when he would come to Los Angeles and San Francisco once a year. And every time he did, he'd make it a point to come to the class. He hasn't been here a while because now his company is sending him to Houston instead of to California. So... But that's Mike McCleary, and he's been the president of the chapter for quite some time. So, and when I was in Tasmania, the father of the pastor, one of the churches that I was speaking in, let me stay at his place because they were out of town. They actually had a home right by one of the tributaries of the Brisbane River. So that's their backyard, looking down towards the river. And then this is the river from their property, and then looking the other direction. So I got a few minutes to actually walk down to the river and see what's going on. But it was interesting. They knew I was a runner. And they said, when you run here in Australia, please stay on the roads or paths and make sure the grass is shorter than this. I said, why? They said, are snakes. And I said, well, how do you tell which ones are poisonous and which ones aren't poisonous? They said, don't worry, in Australia they're all poisonous. But he says the thing you especially got to watch out for are the poisonous toads. And because they're poisons on their skin. And so they said, when you're running, make sure you look down at the path you're running on. Because what happens is there'll be a squished out toad there. And if you step on the toad, the poison gets on the sole of your foot. And if you touch your shoe, you're going to have a very serious skin rash problem. It's going to be very painful. So when I was running, I had to dodge the squished out snakes and toads. So I figured I don't want to step on a poisonous snake either. So even though it's dead. I thought it was a really nice place I was going to go for a run. So whatever you do, don't go down there. So it was beautiful, but a lot of snakes. So I kept away from that. So, but a little bit about the debate in Perth. And it was originally set up that I was going to be debating the guy who was in charge of Creation Ministries International in Perth. But what happened was the guy who was in charge of the whole thing worldwide flew out from Brisbane to debate me at his own expense, for that matter. So he was quite eager to take that role. And Carl Whelan is a medical doctor, and you know, I had a dinner with him ahead of time. Got to meet his assistant, his administrative assistant. And, you know, he's been in that role for many, many years, literally more than 30 years. And they were the ones that gave birth to Answers in Genesis and loaned out, Ken Ham used to work for Carl Whelan. And then they loaned out Ken Ham to spend some time with Institute for Creation Research. But back in the 1990s, Ken Ham split off from Institute of Creation Research and launched Answers in Genesis USA. And then there's been a major split between Answers in Genesis and the original Australian Answers in Genesis. So the Australian branch has now become Creation Ministries International, and they're now worldwide. They're the second largest young earth creations organization in the world. But what was really interesting is I was able to get my keynote up and running right away, and he couldn't get his PowerPoint to work. And he had a PC, and for some reason the system was just not recognizing a PC. They restarted the system, it still wouldn't recognize the PC. They brought two other PC computers up, wouldn't recognize them either. And I kept telling Carl, look, you know, it'll run on my computer, but he didn't want to give me his PowerPoint. But eventually he had to, because nothing else was working. But I will say this about Carl. He did take out the most egregious slides, so I do appreciate that. But I also realized, and I knew this ahead of time, their speakers essentially go out and speak, give a message of what's wrong with Reasons to Believe and Hugh Ross. In fact, the book they were selling at the back, my name is on the front cover. The entire book is an attack on me personally. And that's one reason why I've been reluctant to debate him. I mean, why do you want to debate someone who's intent on just, you know, putting you in a bad light and insulting you like that? And again, it's because they don't even realize it. They said, we've no reason to apologize. We've done nothing that's wrong. And I said, well, he's not only an insulting towards me, but literally the entire scientific community, and it's going to be difficult to reach these folks. And we had scientists in the audience. By the way, the debate was standing room only. The place was really packed. A lot of unbelievers came. The audience was predominantly young earth. The mayor was there, and she listened to the entire debate. She was going to get up and leave, but I got to speak first, and she got interested. Talked to her a little bit afterwards, and she said, you know, what caught my attention is that your talk had content in it. And that was probably the biggest difference between our two messages. Well, let me qualify that. You know, I kind of gave a review of, here are a few of the biblical reasons why I think the Bible is an older book, and just kind of stuck to the most compelling arguments, a few of which I just shared, how there's no evening and morning for the seventh day. And then on day six, you got both Adam and Eve created. But Genesis 2 tells us many months must have transpired between God creating Adam and God creating Eve. And also made note that this has not been an issue for the church in answering your question. Sorry about not answering your question. The birth of young earth creationism really was the early part of the 20th century. And it was in the Seventh-day Adventist Church. So here you've got this small denomination who is considered in the early part of the 20th century to be a cult, basically infecting the entire evangelical community with this young earth creationism. And mainly it was a reaction to the Darwinian model, and particularly the Scopes trial. That's what really gave attraction. So, but, you know, in the talk I gave, I said, look, this was not an issue, and no one took a definitive stand on this until Isaac Newton. Isaac Newton was the first public figure to take a position, an unambiguous position on the age of the earth. And then I gave a quote from Isaac Newton's letter that he sent to the chaplain of the king, where he just said, you can make the days as long as you want. They're clearly not 24 hours. So, but when Carl got up, what he began by saying is, well, I've read that letter too, and he was clearly a young earth creationist. But he didn't give any evidence to support his point. And likewise, it says, Hugh gave 8 evidences in astronomy and physics why the universe and earth must be old, but here's my list. Any list of 101 scientific evidences for why the earth must be young, he says, overwhelming the science that the earth is young. But it was simply a list. He didn't give any evidence of anything from the list. And it's a list I recognize. It comes from a young earth creationist in Arizona who compiled that list. And that was the way it was through all of his presentation. Lots of lists, but no real evidence for his position. And he basically said, you know, the time is limited. It's true. We only had 30 minutes each. And so you can't do a lot in 30 minutes, but my goal was, I'm not going to give a long list, I'll give just 8. And then, you know, take it from there. Then we had some time to dialogue. I wanted a dialogue with him. And says, you know, let's just have a couple of chairs here, and we'll talk to one another after we've given our presentations. But he insisted that it be set up where, look, I'll ask you 3 questions, you ask me 3 questions, you get 3 minutes to respond to each of your questions, I get 1 minute to rebut what you said. I says, hey, that's a formal debate. That doesn't really, but he insisted that it go that way, and I had to accede to his request. And then it was going to be open for Q&A from the floor, but again, he insisted that, you know, we get the same number of questions each. And I found out later I got 95% of the questions. But they said, no, we're not going to take questions from the floor. They all came back to a computer at the back, and there's a team of younger creationists there and our chapter people that basically picked 3 questions for each of us. And again, it was set up the same way. I would have 3 minutes to answer the questions. He'd get 1 minute to rebut my answer, and there'd be no opportunity for me to rebut his rebuttal. So I was not happy with the way it was set up. To me, debates really don't achieve much. You really want to get dialogue going. But a lot of dialogue happened after the debate was over. So people just came up and just asked all kinds of questions. And mainly what I was talking to were younger creationists who'd never heard an alternative. And once they did, they said, this is all I need. And a lot of people came up and said, I was convinced in the first 5 minutes. So, and they said, I'm so glad you spoke first. Because that just basically settled it for me. And it makes me wonder, how many people around the world only need to hear a few minutes? I mean, what I was hearing in Tasmania was, you know, we never heard a scientific defense for the Christian faith before. And once they heard it, they said, that's all I need. So I had scientists and engineers and doctors literally making a commitment right there on the spot. They kept saying, why is it that we don't hear these evidences? Well, I said, you know, Australia is dominated by atheists. They're not going to tell you this stuff. And then in the Christian community, it's dominated by young earth creationists, and they're not going to tell you this stuff, because if they do, it becomes quickly obvious that that's not compatible with a young earth view. I mean, that's my kind of lead point. We got the space-time theorems, Big Bang cosmology. the design of the universe, but those are evidences, origin of life, origin of humanity, those are evidences that really only fly in an old earth context. And so and that was interesting too from Carl Wieland. He made a big deal about how Neanderthals were fully human, and then gave a list of evidences that they're fully human, namely that they had temple worship, they had hearths, they wore clothes and jewelry, art and music, and of course none of that is correct. So but just put it up there, and again didn't give any evidence for it. Well, okay, this was common 30 years ago in the scientific literature, where they would find Neanderthal remains, and then maybe 20 feet away they would find some flower pollen. So they are assuming that these Neanderthals were putting flowers on the graves of dead Neanderthals. Well, that's one way you could interpret the data, but obviously there's other ways that data could be interpreted. And they would find charcoal beside Neanderthal remains, and they assumed that they were cooking their food. And they also found some okra in one spot, and they said they must have been painting. And a lot of those sites where they found that evidence, it was a cave that was being used first by Neanderthals and later by human beings. And then what happened is that people began to visit these caves, they stirred all the material up. So the truth is, we don't know what that material corresponds to, either Neanderthals or humans. And this is common in the scientific literature today. They admit that there is no case that Neanderthals exhibited any of this behavior. I mean, you don't find sewing implements, for example. There's zero evidence that they ever wore clothes. Whereas with humans, you see an abundance of evidence immediately. Sewing implements are all there. There's a question over here. Yes?
I just wanted to comment that you had there was a similar reaction to this, the idea that this is what this is the information I've been needing all along. Out of the Baptist Church out here in the San Gabriel Valley that was really so receptive to your message. A guy, I was at the book table, and a guy came up. This is the information I've been waiting for. You know, this fills the gap.
Right. Well, that's what I was trying to do with certain pastors, is explain to them why, because they were amazed at how people were making a turn in just such a short period of time. And it says, you know, it tells us in the Bible, people perish for a lack of knowledge. And that's all they really needed, was that knowledge. And there's a reason why you're not hearing it in Australia, again, because the atheists don't want to present it, and the younger creationists don't want to present it. And so, and people just were persuaded. These are the two choices we have. And a lot of people said, we didn't like the choices. You're a person, I'll come back to you.
I was at, five years ago, I was in Germany, and I went to the Neanderthal Valley,
mm-hmm.
where they found, they had a quarry there, and they were working on
the... That's where they found the first one. The
first one. And they had a museum there, and they had a typical Neanderthal site right by the river, which is even called the zoo, and they could have been any like a Native American almost, except the huts were a little different. But they were using stone tools, and they were using weapons. I mean, how you know, very very simple. They're very human. I'm saying,
well, that's how museums will often depict them, Al.
But if you go there, they that's where they found them, you know. So, who are you going to believe? Somebody, you know.
Well. Okay, this is what you've got with Neanderthals. There is evidence that they were taking, you know, sticks and using them as spears to kill animals, and they're also using stones. But their tools consisted of a single stone or a single piece of wood. Whereas with humans, what you get are humans taking wood and stones and sinews and making an axe, making a shovel, making a hammer.
No,
you don't see that in any of the Neanderthal finds.
They have the funeral rites too.
Well, again, they claim that. But again, it's based on evidence where they find a few pollen grains 20 feet away from a Neanderthal bone, and they make the presumption they must have been putting flowers on a grave. Well, I mean, obviously they're reading a lot in between the lines. And, you know, the one place where they found the quote, you know, they thought, well, maybe we got evidence, because there's a big argument. Neanderthals clearly used tools, just like chimpanzees used tools. I mean, same kind of tool use. But did the tool use advance? And there was one paper where they said we have proof that it advanced, but it was a single cave where the human remains and the Neanderthal remains were so mixed up they couldn't date anything.
Well, this is just
and that's the only piece of evidence they've got.
But in that valley, that was just Neanderthal. That's what they found.
Right. But what you got is people reading between the lines.
I mean, they were killing three big animals.
They were killing animals.
They wore furs. And made
no, there's no evidence they wore furs.
You got to go to that museum, though.
Well. Yeah, those were not recovered Neanderthal furs.
Neanderthals ate men?
Well, here's one reason why we do know that they did not wear clothes, is that their bodies were wonderfully designed for living in a cold climate. But when humans moved into their territory, humans very quickly began to occupy climate zones 10 and 15 degrees colder than what Neanderthals could handle. And what they realize is where you see the limitation of Neanderthal habitation is where they could live naked. So they were not able to move into a climate zone that required clothing. But humans immediately did.
What did they do with the animals they killed? I mean, that's
they ate them.
It's very common sense. If you've got a brain like we have, you kill an animal, hey, we can use it for fur.
Well,
what do they do with the fur?
Yeah, they leave the fur behind. So
we have evidence that chimpanzees don't raid other tribes and killing the apes and eating them cannibalism, but they don't wear their furs when they get sent out.
No, they don't wear their furs.
Be careful what museums you go to, because if you go to a Young Earth Museum, you'll see people have dinosaurs together, and you'll come back and tell me that people have dinosaurs left together because you saw it in a museum. So be careful what museums you go to, okay?
Well, bottom line is you want to read the scientific literature in terms of what you can believe and what you can't believe.
To believe that they intermarried.
Now that's actually disappearing from the scientific literature as well. Yeah. So. Yeah, I mean, I heard that claim too. They said, well, Neanderthals have bigger brains than we do. Actually, their brain size is about the same as ours. But it's the encephalization quotient that makes a difference. How big your brain is relative to your body mass. And that's where humans are way ahead of the Neanderthals. So, for example, there are other animals that have bigger brains than us. Elephants have a bigger brain than we do. But keep in mind, a lot of your brain has to support all the muscle mass in your body. And so we human beings, not having a lot of muscle mass, we're able to use our brain power for other things than trying to throw a baseball or hit a golf club. So,
well, and birds are some of the smartest animals, and they have...
They have a high encephalation quotient.
But a very small brain.
Right. Yeah, it's the size of the brain relative to the body mass.
And they're smarter than chimpanzees.
Well, I gave a talk on that in Australia because I knew there was a strong... Because that's the sentiment of younger creationism, is that Neanderthals are fully human. And that, you know, those of us who are of Northern European descent, we're definitely Neanderthals. So... And by the way, they didn't think that was an insult at all, because after all, they said Neanderthals have bigger brains. So,
How do they deal with all the recent DNA evidence showing that they are not related to us?
Well, there's a paper, a single paper, that claims they might have tentative evidence that Neanderthals and human interbred, and that's what Carl was appealing to. And the reason why I didn't like the debate structure, I didn't have an opportunity to respond to the claims he was making. But what the paper says is that we have found a signal that's about three times above the noise, that maybe there was a little more similarity in comparing human DNA with Neanderthal DNA, where the humans are Europeans or Asians, as opposed to sub-Saharan Africans. So they said that means that since Neanderthals lived in Europe and Asia, that maybe they interbred with humans. Now, if you read the paper, they're very tentative in their claims. And they're also, however, very explicit that Neanderthals were a distinct species. They said, yes, the DNA is similar, but it's so different from human DNA that it's a totally different species. And they also made the point, we only saw this apparent signal in the Y chromosome DNA. It doesn't show up in the mitochondrial DNA at all. And one of the things they concluded in their paper is that the level of bestiality at that time, if this signal is real, is a lot less than it is today. So that's always been a taboo against humans having sexual intercourse with non-human animals. However, I want to tell you this. In the physical sciences, we don't publish a result unless we got a signal that's at least 5 times higher than the noise. But in biology, often you're forced to publish a signal that's 3 or 4 times above the noise. But they were honest and said, look, it's a weak signal. We're not saying it's real. And the thing I noticed right away when I looked at the paper, it said 11 authors. I looked at the 11 authors. They're all Europeans and Asians. It says there's not a single sub-Saharan African on the list. And that's why I wrote an article on our website saying, before we give any credence to this study, we need to have the experiment redone where we're using sub-Saharan Africans. Why? Because the 11 authors made the point, we can't rule out human contamination. And when you handle Neanderthal DNA, there's always a possibility that your DNA is going to get mixed in. In fact, they were also cautious in the paper saying, we found this difference in the DNA between humans and Neanderthals. The difference might be bigger because we can't rule out the possibility of contamination. Now, so I read the paper. They explained how careful they were to avoid that contamination. So I would say they did the best job they could, but they were also honest in saying that we can't rule out that possibility. And if you read Fuzz's article on the Neanderthal human interbreeding controversy, he makes reference to a paper that got published about 2 years later after this thing was published, where they said they've reestablished the date for the extinction of Neanderthals. Namely, instead of Neanderthals going extinct 30,000 years ago, the new and much more reliable date is 48,000 years ago. Now that means humans had no contact with Neanderthals, because humans only entered Neanderthal territory 40,000 years ago. And so that's kind of the position that you'll see in our website, is that there couldn't have been any Neanderthal-human interbreeding. But that was a key part of Carl Wieland's debate. And you know, the young Earth position is Homo erectus is fully human, Neanderthals are fully human, Homo sapiens idelta is fully human, and all the rest of the bipedal primate finds are fakes or frauds. So, but they do realize the evidence is overwhelming that Homo erectus and Neanderthals existed. They claim the dates are all wrong, that they're all recent, and that even Homo erectus is part of the human species.
What answer do they give that, well, we get DNA off of the Neanderthal population? So if Homo erectus is fully human, we should be able to get DNA off them, but we can't because it's so old. How do they respond?
Well, they haven't got a response for that. I didn't get a chance to ask that question. So, but yeah, it's a powerful argument. If Homo erectus is fully human, we should have DNA, and we don't. And even with Neanderthal, the DNA is so corrupted that there's no way it can be a recent date for Neanderthals. I mean, you got an obvious signal of decay, and decay takes time. Now, they do have an answer for that. They claim the decay was much more rapid during the flood than it was at other times. But then that gets into the problems of their flood model. In the back.
Okay. I forgot. I'm sure you covered this. But why is it that they want them to be human? I mean, and then what do they think? Like on the 6-day God breathed something into them to make us? What is their point? To fit into a timeline or what?
No, their point is this. They realize that they cannot deny the overwhelming evidence these creatures existed. I mean, they claim that the evidence for, say, the Australopithecines is not substantial enough to be believed, but they know that argument won't work with Neanderthals and Homo erectus. There's just too many finds. We got bones, and with Neanderthals, we got the DNA. So the response to that is to say they're recent, they've only been around for the last 6,000 years, and they're fully human. And they say, notice, we got people on the planet today that are as short in stature as Homo erectus. And that's true. I mean,
so they were animals? I mean, they were like people, but they didn't have the spirit brought in?
Oh, no. They claim they were fully spiritual. In other words, they say that all the Neanderthals and Homo erectus are the direct offspring of Adam and Eve.
Oh, direct offspring. Uh-huh. So Adam and Eve were probably Neanderthals.
Well,
that's true.
It has to be. They say that there's people around today that look like Neanderthals.
Yeah, that's what their claim is. You put a suit on a Neanderthal, that they would look like somebody walking down the street. And maybe that would be true in downtown New York, but I don't know about anywhere else. Yes.
Edit that out.
On the topic, you've got to touch on tear ducts and the sinuses, because that to me, that totally obviously, you know, puts them not only out obviously being human, but totally puts them out of even obviously lineage of us coming from them.
Well, it's one reason why I'm reluctant to date somebody that doesn't have an academic PhD. I mean, Carl Whelan, he's a medical doctor, hasn't practiced medicine in over 20 years, and wasn't aware that all this stuff has been refuted in the scientific literature. Because, you know, it is true, 40 years ago, the claim in the scientific literature was that Neanderthals were anatomically identical to human beings. And Carl made that claim in a debate. Well, I mean, no anthropologist believes that. There's now overwhelming evidence that Neanderthals are anatomically distinct. As I mentioned earlier, they have a body shape and design that's great if you're living in a cold climate. They've got much shorter limbs than we have. They're barrel-shaped, and they have a nasal capacity that's enormous. It's important when you live in a cold climate to be able to breathe in cold air and have that air warm up before it gets to your throat and down into your lungs. You know, we humans do it with a parka. Neanderthal, not wearing clothes, had to have a huge nasal capacity. And likewise, the hole that receives the spinal column, I think for humans it's circular, for Neanderthals it's elliptical. The jaw structure is very different. But see, none of this was discovered until the last few decades. And so nobody in the textbooks today would say that they're anatomically identical.
And I cry. Can anybody tell me the answer? I cry. And I like proving.
Yep.
Could that be gradualism, evolution?
Well, the thing we notice, and I write this in our books, is that when you look at Neanderthal, the oldest Neanderthals look the same as the most recent. We see no evolution in their bone structure. We see no evolution that we can measure in their DNA. Well, that's the whole point. They've only been around for 100,000 years. But see, if you don't get evolution of a big primate in 100,000 years, then there can't be a descent of man theory to explain our origins. In other words, these different bipedal primates are all products of special creation. God created them. They existed for a while here on Earth, but they existed without change. They went extinct, and they're replaced by a different species.
They're not in the Bible, though. The Bible, they're all Jews.
A Jewish man.
I don't lose your speaking privilege in this class. I don't want to hear that talk.
All right.
I never want to hear that talk again.
Well, that is another kind of, you know, terms of a racial comment like that. I frequently in Australia had to deal with the charge that, quote, I'm a racist. And this has been promoted by CMI, that I'm a racist. And the whole point is that they have claimed that there's this Jimnian cave that has a date of 60,000 years ago for Aboriginal habitation. And the reasons to believe model is that humans were in one locale. And he actually said this in the debate. He never called me a racist, but he says this is the model that Hugh Ross promotes. That you know, humanity was local, there was a flood, and after the flood, humanity became global. And that migration happened somewhere in the neighborhood of 40,000 years ago. But he says, we have evidence that Aborigines were here 60,000 years ago. Now, he didn't say this in the debate, but what I've seen elsewhere is that this means that we're taking a racist perspective in claiming that the Aborigines are subhuman. But hey, 12 years ago I wrote an article on our website where I said that Jimnian cave date, of 60,000 years ago, it's not a radiocarbon date. It's a thermoluminescence date. And we need to look at that 60,000 years as an upper limit, not an actual date. Well, about a year after I wrote that paper, they actually found some charcoal and some seeds at the Jindian site, and they calibrated that thermoluminescence date as 3,000 years ago. So the Jindian cave evidence is 3,000 years old, not 60,000 years old. And if you look in the scientific literature, the earliest dates we have for Aborigines being in Australia are in the highs 30s of thousands of years ago, somewhere between 35 and 38,000 years ago. So in that sense, it's quite compatible. But it was difficult for me to have to keep listening to these charges that we believe that the Aborigines were subhuman. It's like, wait a minute, guys. If you just go on our website, it's all there. But that was the other thing that was disturbing. They quote stuff from me that's 35 years old. And they said, look, this is where Hugh Ross got it wrong. And I said, well, that was 35 years ago. I mean, things change. And, I have made mistakes, but we corrected the mistakes before you guys discovered them. So that's the kind of stuff I had to deal with. So, in the back.
That I saw on YouTube a presentation by Ken Bovine, and he was kind of whining and complaining that answers in Genesis had really slammed him in their literature. So it's kind of they're slamming everybody.
Yeah, they have a hard time getting along with one another,
right,
and alone. So, but I discovered that's kind of the Australian mentality. So, it's not just the young earth creationists. It seems to be, and people tell me, hey, when you got that few people per square mile, and I'm from Canada, that's another place that's highly underpopulated, and I kind of see, not quite to the same extreme, but I also see that happening in Canada. So, well, it's not just that, it's that people tend to isolate themselves. So, for example, I grew up in Canada not meeting Christians until I left the country. And it's not that there aren't Christians in Canada, they isolate themselves. So, for example, outside of Vancouver, if you go east about 40 miles, 45 miles, there's a community that's more than 80% evangelical Christians. But where I live, it was less than 1%. So, and
when they isolate themselves, not...
Well, I think they feel attacked by the secular society, so they kind of form their own communities, which is what I like about America. At least here, the Christians are integrated into the society. And where you get good integration, I think it really diminishes the polarization. And so, that's it. I don't want to badmouth Australia, because one thing I did like about Australia, and I saw this 20 years ago, they may strongly disagree with you, but if you're up there speaking, they listen. Whereas sometimes what I hear in America, they'll come to my event, but they don't listen. They pay attention. And because they pay attention, explains why so many of them were able to make a turn in just one evening. And by the way, I've met a lot of pastors. In fact, the two pastors that sponsored me in Brisbane were both Young Earth pastors. But they said, hey, because of what we heard in Tasmania, we thought we'd like to have you come in. We don't agree with you, but we're prepared to have you speak. And unlike what I see here in the U.S., they gave me a decent introduction. It really bothers me when I come up in a church where the pastor says, we're bringing Hugh Ross in. He's old earth. I disagree with him, but I want you to hear what he's got to say, even though I don't agree with anything he says. I didn't get that in Australia. The pastors were gracious in their introduction, but also they told me afterwards, I'm no longer Young Earth. What I heard today is very persuasive. And what they basically said is, I'm an evangelist at heart, and now I can really do evangelism. Says, I always felt crippled before, and now I can start doing it. So,
Australia was the birthplace of Peter Allen.
Well, it could be. I don't know who Peter Allen is. So, it could be. I'm not really big on entertainment. So,
who's the pastor of Church Underwear was?
Oh, that is
Jack Hayford.
Just
a totally wonderful guy. And wasn't it around 20 years ago he went to his congregation and said, I've been telling you wrong?
He did. Yeah, I got to share this with Carl and a few other people, is that because he was asking me about my relationships with the Institute of Creation Research, and I says, well, I can remember having lunch with Henry Morris and, you know, talking about the universe, and he says, I see why you're convinced that the universe is old. It says it's very compelling. It says, how about if I take the position that the universe is billions of years old and the Earth is only thousands of years old? And I said, well, Henry, that's a step in the right direction, but the best book that you ever wrote is a book you wrote a few years ago on why it's impossible to separate the age of the Earth from the age of the universe. And he laughed at me and says, oh, you read that book. And I says, well, what do you think? And he says, well, I think I still agree with what I wrote in that book. Then he looked at me and said, I really can't change my position. I've invested way too much in this young Earth position, and our whole organization is founded on it. He says, you know the things I've said about you and other old Earth creationists. I just can't, you know, see myself at this stage changing. And my comment to Henry was, the church has a reputation of always rewarding those who are able to humble themselves and change their point of view. And a great example of that is Jack Hayford. For years he taught the young Earth message from the pulpit, but without telling anybody, he got up the pulpit one Sunday and said, I've been doing a lot of reading and studying on this issue, and I'm telling you now as your pastor, I'm no longer young Earth. I'm a day age creationist. Here's why. And the entire congregation gave him a standing ovation. So, yeah. And that's an example where he was actually rewarded for, quote, changing a position that he'd held for many years. But Henry didn't really think that that would happen. So,
I heard Henry Morris at Lake Avenue. It must have been one of the last times that he came. He was in his, like, 80s.
Yes.
And there were a lot of Caltech people there, and they were asking some very pointed questions. And he said, I am old, I'm half blind, I don't hear well, I can't answer these questions anymore.
Hmm.
So it was like he didn't want to face it, or I don't know, whatever.
Well, again, that's the reputation I heard in Australia, is that you really don't get a lot of engagement time. So, but anyway, it was a great time. Got a lot to see a lot of people, you know, actually listen and consider and change their minds, atheists as well as younger creationists. And once again, I saw people actually shaking hands with one another where they're on the two different sides and saying, you know, this is a position we both can embrace. So, and that's really what I enjoy doing, is seeing people who are divided and hostile with one another actually getting reconciled to one another, and you know, seeing that there is a creative alternative. So, and we're going to get a chapter in Brisbane. We're going to get a chapter in Tasmania. That's going to be, I think, quite exciting. And by the way, our Perth people said we want to organize the whole continent of Australia for reasons to believe. So, hey, we're in Psalm 147 and 148. Oh, no, we got another. Wait a minute. What, I was looking at this clock. I thought I had 20 more minutes. I got 2 minutes. I would have cut my report down. I'm very much apologized. So. How did these two clocks get... All right, we need to get that fixed for next Sunday, guys. All right. But let me just quickly read for you Psalm 148, because I've not done this before. It really fits into the context of what we've been teaching about the frozen precipitation. Psalm 148. Let me just back up a bit into Psalm 147. These two psalms really go together. Speaking of God, He spreads the snow like wool. He scatters the frost like ashes. He hands down or hurls down His hail like pebbles. And there it's referring to three different kinds of frozen precipitation: snow, frost, and hail. And if you've been with us, we've been talking about how all of those are critical if you want to have advanced civilization. If all you got is rain coming down, you will not have the slow melting water that you need for the crops. And you actually see this in Psalm 148. Praise the Lord. Praise the Lord from the heavens. Praise Him in the heights above. Praise Him, all His angels. Praise Him, all His heavenly hosts. Praise Him, sun and moon. Praise Him, all you shining stars. Praise Him, you highest heavens, and you waters above the skies. Let them praise the name of the Lord. For He commanded, and they were created. He set them in place. He gave a decree that will never pass away. Praise the Lord from the earth, you great sea creatures and all ocean depths. Lightning and hail, snow and clouds, stormy winds that do His bidding. You mountains and all hills, fruit trees and all cedars, wild animals and all cattle, small creatures and flying birds, kings of the earth and all the nations, you princes and all rulers on earth, young men and maidens, old men and children, let them praise the name of the Lord, for His name alone is revealed. His splendor is above the earth and above the heavens. Now, what you're getting here is a list in the context of what you see in other creation psalms and in Job. These are all the items you need for humans to be able to launch civilization and take the good news of salvation to all the people and groups of the world. That's kind of what we've been doing in the past year, is going through all these items and saying, we need this. And where I want to take you, I'll take you there next week, is why we need these huge sheets of ice, thousands of feet thick, that cover all of Canada, that cover all of Russia, actually come down through, even all the way down here to California. California, Northern California, had thousands of feet of ice just a few tens of thousands of years ago. Yeah, we had that. Yosemite, Yosemite Valley was carved out by a giant glacier coming down that valley. Actually sheared a mountain in two, half dome. And that was just a few tens of thousands of years ago. But without that, we wouldn't have our civilization today. I mean, we're still benefiting from the close of the last ice age. Now, there's only pieces of it today. So, for example, here in North America, the only big ice sheets left from the last ice age are in Alaska and British Columbia. But it's the melting of that water that allows North America to grow the abundant crops that it's able to grow. What is it that feeds the Mississippi? What is it that feeds the great rivers that run through the Canadian prairies? It's the meltwaters from the last ice age. And when that ice is gone, they'll no longer be able to grow the food that we're able to grow. Now, every 100,000 years, we get an ice age. Ice age lasts 90,000 years. You get a warm interglacial, that's 10,000 years. As I'm going to share with you next week, we have detailed records of the last dozen ice ages. But the ice age cycle we're in right now is unlike any other in the history of the Earth. It's got special features that make possible the development of high technology civilization. We couldn't have done it in any other ice age. Only in this ice age is it possible for humanity to launch and sustain the kind of technology we need to fulfill the Great Commission. Which means there's a very narrow time window in which God could have put human beings on planet Earth and have us fulfill the role for which He created us. We're in that narrow time zone. So in that sense, I'm a young Earth creationist. There's only a few thousand years in which it can all happen. But it takes billions of years in order to set up that narrow window of time in which we could achieve the purpose for which God created us in just thousands of years and not millions of years. And that's kind of the message I had in Australia. Says, yeah, people ask me, couldn't God do it more rapidly? He sure could. He could have set up the universe and the earth with different laws of physics, so it's only thousands of years old, but now we would need millions of years to fulfill the Great Commission. Says, I think it's better to have the universe billions of years old where we can fulfill the Great Commission in just thousands of years. So in that sense, I really am a young earth creationist. Well, we've got a lot of laughs, as I actually explained. You know, in the early part of the 20th century, there is a huge debate in the astronomical community. Is it Big Bang, or is it a hesitating universe model, or a steady state universe model? And the reason why is people looked at Big Bang and said it only gives us billions of years. And with only billions of years, we cannot sustain the Darwinian interpretation of the origin of life and the history of life. We need a minimum of 10 quadrillion years. And so it was actually a big effort in the astronomical community how can we look at stars so they can burn for at least trillions of years? But the development of the 20th century was a recognition stars can't burn for trillions of years. They can only burn for billions of years. If the universe were a trillion years old, there'd be no stars left. They'd all be burnt out. And so what you had in astronomy was a debate between young universe astronomers who believed in only billions of years and old universe astronomers who believed in quadrillions of years. So I introduced myself as a middle-aged creationist. So, and I'm a middle-aged creationist in both senses of the word. So that's enough. Let me close in prayer. Father in heaven, I do thank you for the opportunity to go to Australia and see for myself the degree of polarization that's existing there. But also, Lord, thank you for the admonitions I got from so many Christian leaders there that what's happening in Australia, we're beginning to see it happen here in America as well. And there's so many lessons we can draw from there, Lord, that we can use here in the United States of America, here in the North American continent, that we may not go down the same path, where we can actually see people raised in the church, not only surviving in their Christian faith, but becoming productive. And Father, I pray that as we continue in this class, we'd all become better equipped at being able to present a case for Christ as Creator, Lord, and Savior. And Lord, that we would be ready to give good reasons for the hope within us, but to do it with gentleness, respect, and a clear conscience, that through our demeanor and our words, people would realize there is a Creator that loves them and has a plan for the life, not just for this universe, but for the new creation to come. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.